Welcome to Oncology Data Advisor, where we explore the latest advances in cancer research and patient care. Thanks for listening to this episode. Be sure to visit oncdata.com for more content, including expert perspectives from leading oncology thought leaders, FDA approvals, patient advocacy, and much more. And don't forget to subscribe to Oncology Data Advisor on social media to stay up to date on the latest videos, podcasts, and more.
All right. Hi, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us today for Rare Disease Day. We have a really exciting discussion planned for today about some rare diseases that our panelists treat and some insights about how to improve treatment options for them. So we're really looking forward to the discussion. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Rahul Banerjee, our editor-in-chief, to get started with some introductions.
Wonderful. Thank you, Kira, for that kind introduction. Thank you all for listening. Today is I think it's by accident that it happens to be a leap year day today, but today's February 29th, and we're here to celebrate Rare Disease Day. Rare diseases are much rarer than leap years are, but I think it's an important topic that, you know, all of us, this will be both oncology and hematology we'll talk about, and I'm glad that we'll have the chance to do it. Maybe I actually can change a little bit, and I'll have us each introduce ourselves. There are three of us panelists, or maybe a fourth one joining. If she joins, I'll also stop and introduce her as well. I can go first. My name is Rahul Banerjee. I'm an assistant professor of medicine at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle, Washington, also at the University of Washington in Seattle, Washington. I specialize in multiple myeloma, which I wouldn't necessarily call a rare disorder, but there are very many, you know, paraneoplastic conditions or preneoplastic conditions that can cause symptoms in this space of plasma cell disorders, for example, AL amyloidosis, POEM syndromes, Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, and we'll talk about those as they come. I'm excited to be here. Maybe Matt, Dr. Hadfield, I can go to you next.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. I'm so excited to be doing this. And again, happy leap year to everyone. I'm Matt Hadfield. I'm a third-year medical oncology fellow at Brown University in the Legarreta Cancer Center in Providence, Rhode Island, and will be staying on there, focusing in melanoma and cutaneous malignancies, as well as early drug development and phase one clinical trials. And similarly to Dr. Banerjee, melanoma is not a rare disease necessarily, but it is on the more uncommon spectrum. And one of the topics I'm, you know, hoping to talk about a little bit today is uveal melanoma, which is quite rare and has had some very interesting advancements in terms of FDA approvals in the last couple of years. So very excited to be having this conversation.
Wonderful. Thank you, Matt. Dr. Kallis?
Yes. Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me here today. I'm Joe Kallis. I'm a oncology specialist pharmacist with the UC Health System here in Colorado Springs, Colorado. So the practice that I'm part of, we see all comers. So I get nothing particularly rare about that. But we've had more recent cases lately of PNH, paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, and then some others. So I'll be focusing on those today.
Wonderful. Very nice to have you. And I think we have our fourth panelist just joined. So Dr. Sitaram, can I have you introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. Sorry, always running. I am a thoracic and a head and neck oncologist. So within this space, I see a lot of rare tumors, particularly salivary gland, some rare thyroid cancers, thymic tumors, parathyroid cancers, really not midline carcinomas. These are all extremely rare tumors. So I had the privilege to work with these patients, and I'm excited that we are having a discussion about this today.
Absolutely. Likewise. So we'll go into it. And I think, you know, again, we'll make this because rare diseases obviously are not just the cancer. Many of us treat both, you know, hematologic malignancies and non-malignant hematologic conditions and oncology or some permutation thereof. So we actually will pivot first and let's talk about classical hematology, non-malignant hematology. And maybe Dr. Kallis, Joe, if I may, start with you. Maybe just kind of talk us through, you know, you mentioned, for example, PNH just now when your introductory remarks, you know, how you approach that, you know, what are some examples of rare diseases? And in the last 10 years, you know, where have we made progress with new drugs and where haven't we?
Certainly. So kind of just by way of background, PNH and paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, I won't say that five times fast. But it's really a rare acquired disorder. So it's happening because of genetic mutations after someone's born, whereas, you know, germline would happen when they are born. They get they're born with it. But really what characterizes PNH is just a loss of some cell surface proteins for signaling that really block the complement pathway. So allowing the the body to recognize itself as itself. But when these proteins are missing, that's when we can end up with either chronic or paroxysmal hemolysis, which then carries with it an increased risk of clotting, organ dysfunction, and even in some severe cases, dysplastic bone marrow. And where patients just aren't forming the cells that they need for their normal daily lives. Since it is a rare disease, I thought it'd be helpful to put some statistics to keep it in perspective. We're looking here at anywhere between 1 to 10 cases per million people. And there's some thought now that that could even be underestimated because it's a challenging condition to diagnose. And then I think sometimes it could even be a diagnosis of exclusion. But as you mentioned, Rahul, over the past 10 years, there have been some treatment advances. You know, I think back when I was starting my career 10 to 12 years ago, we had eculizumab, so a complement inhibiting medication, carried with it some risks of infection, but really, because we can't add that surface protein back to a patient's cells, trying to block, you know, the part of the immune system that's causing some of the concern and the conditions. What I was going to focus on today is more kind of the next generation, if you will, of the complement inhibitors, a more recently approved drug called ravulizumab or Ultomiris, if those of you out there are familiar with brand names. I think as the pharmacist, I think generically, my wife is also a pharmacist, so we joke about that or some interesting dinner table conversations. But ravulizumab, somewhat unique in that it's got a more favorable schedule for patients. They're not having to come in as often. You know, eculizumab could be given every 2 weeks indefinitely. But with ravulizumab, it's still functioning just as a complement inhibitor. And we can't change the patient's genetics and cells, but we can block or blunt that part of the immune system that's leading to these symptoms. I think one thing I would encourage folks to keep in mind is that with ravulizumab, it does come with some risks of infection. So being able to prophylax patients, you know, Neisseria meningitis is a concern, some vaccinations that are often required both before and then even after or during. But it's a condition and then a drug that I really wanted to focus on today for Rare Disease Day. It's something that's come up recently in my practice, but have any of my fellow board members here seen patients recently with PNH or used ravulizumab?
So I've used eculizumab off-label for any number of complement-mediated pathways. You know, in myeloma space, carfilzomib, for example, can sometimes cause thrombotic microangiopathies. I think it's funny that you're calling it next generation, which I agree with. We have a class that works for these patients and going up a step. Maybe we can all go around. If any of you have expertise or have seen patients like this, feel free to chime in. I mean, I think one thing I'll ask you about, Joe, is that you had mentioned the infectious risk. And I remember that. Mm-hmm. I feel like many physicians know this drug purely because on boards, if you see the word eculizumab, the answer is automatically meningococcal. Like, you know, no questions asked. And obviously in real life, things are more complicated than that. These are real patients living with this, having many, many side effects. For a rare disease like this, as rare as you said, you know, what evidence is there? You know, how do you figure out what prophylaxis schedule, how often to give them, you know, the meningococcal vaccines, you know, antibiotics, IVIG? You know, we don't have great data. So how do you go into the unknown with supportive care for this kind of paradigm?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's recommendations out now that, you know, if you're able to, at least 2 weeks before starting ravulizumab to vaccinate patients with the available meningococcal bacteria vaccine. So looking at least the serogroups A, C, W, Y, and then also meningococcal B. The flip side here is if the risks of delaying therapy to give the vaccination outweigh the benefits, then you, of course, could give ravulizumab first. But that's where I would really focus on. You know, if you see ravulizumab, eculizumab, you think meningococcal right after that, but then you're really focusing just on the immunization aspect. So ideally 2 weeks before starting therapy, if possible. If not, then as soon as possible after a patient begins.
Which makes sense. Innately, ravulizumab shouldn't impair someone's ability to mount the response to vaccines, I think, right? So it should work when you do it. Okay, mm-hmm. That's helpful.
Right, you know, so just blunting more the complement-mediated pathways, but not affecting necessarily B-cell or antibody function.
Yeah.
Joe, one of the interesting things that I've seen, at least in other novel therapeutics in this type of space, there's a name that escapes me, but a new drug for TTP, And one of the things that I've seen is that with given the rarity that we use these drugs, the cost is remarkably high, and sometimes can be, you know, very, very challenging for patients. And you know, I've been in situations, again, speaking in TTP, but a similar situation where, you know, you try and get access to, you know, through the company or through insurance. Have you seen that with this drug? And do you have any insight or advice on how to grease wheels faster if you find yourself in such a situation?
Certainly. Yeah. I think you might be referring to like caplizumab or Cablivi for TTP. Yeah. That really hits the nail on the head. I mean, many of the drugs we use have high costs anyway, and then you get into a rare disease space where there aren't that many patients, and then you end up with subsequently higher cost for the drugs. I know at my institution, we've got a really robust kind of financial assistance team who's out there so that they're able, you know, if we identify that, you know, maybe there's an insurance gap or there's no insurance or no coverage at all, to really help secure free drug from the companies. And the challenge that comes along with that is sometimes the documentation that's required for the company programs, and then often the turnaround. It's like, even if we've done everything you can, everything's been turned in, it's often that, you know, I want to start the drug yesterday, but we're waiting multiple business days to try and get it for somebody.
Right.
I haven't found any home run type strategies for that. One thing, again, being in pharmacy that I found somewhat helpful is I do keep contact information for like some of the medical science liaisons or even reps for those products, because in cases where we have that urgent need, I've often found that somebody on the inside at the pharma company can often grease the skids, so to speak, to speed things along.
Absolutely.
Excellent, excellent point, and agreed on all fronts. I think in the interest of time, unless Joe, do you want to speak some more about caplizumab, or should we, you want to move on to the next topic?
I think briefly, just for caplizumab, yeah. Since TTP, you know, acquired condition, what I would just briefly emphasize here is that, similar to how ravulizumab is blocking complement, caplizumab is blocking the function of von Willebrand factor so that the platelets can't really adhere to each other. Because with TTP, we're more concerned about some of the micro thrombotic angiopathy and other things that are happening. But to Dr. Hadfield's point, again, expensive drug, something that if we need to use it, we need it quickly.
Right.
I mean, the tricky part, as both of you kind of alluded to, I'm sure caplizumab would pay for itself eventually, right? Because yeah, these patients, you know, they're not requiring plasma exchange, like Plex is often, maybe shorter hospitalizations. And it's just hard to do a cost effectiveness analysis here. A lot of them obviously have industry partnerships writing the cost effectiveness analysis. And people say, oh, this is a biased study. And obviously for payers, it's hard to convince a payer that, like, look, you know, If you think about this, you actually, these newer medications are making your patient feel better and saving you money, but it's hard to prove.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Joe.
Oh, just going to briefly add that, exactly. You know, we've got effective medications, kind of cutting edge type of therapies that I think can save time and then take the place of perhaps multiple courses of what we would have used otherwise.
Agreed. And so maybe the last thing I'll say before we pivot to Matt and Nagasri for our next panelist for the malignancy side is that, again, I forgot to reemphasize this point. So two things, actually. One, for caplizumab, for readers who are interested, so actually Oncology Data Advisor does have a, you know, free CME activity about current standards and new directions in the treatment of acquired TTP, with Dr. Catalan as the presenter from the Ohio State University. So there you get a lot more about caplizumab. The one thing I'll say about eculizumab, just as an example, is that even though it is approved for this super rare disease, it does come, if the drug is extremely helpful in other scenarios, that, for example, a multiple myeloma is not rare. I treat it. I wouldn't call it rare, maybe not as common as other cancers, but common. And I have used eculizumab off-label for different pathways, that the same pathway, but a different issue. So like carfilzomib-mediated TMAs, as we had discussed. So that's a good example where, yes, you may say that these rare diseases, you know, that the market share is so small for them. But I think when we have them, that innovation pays off for other patients as well. So maybe we can pivot now to the malignancy setting. Maybe what we can do, Matt and Nagashri, if you're willing, is we can do maybe, Matt, maybe you have present one from kind of your arena. You can choose. I think you had mentioned you wanted to talk about uveal melanoma, which I think would be fascinating. And then Nagashri, maybe we can go to you next and talk about an example. Basically, what we're discussing is, you know, what changed in the last 10 years with these, you know, rare conditions and what needs to change in terms of pharmacology, you know, better medications, better diagnostics, supportive care, and so forth. So Matt, I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Uveal melanoma is something I felt particularly compelled to talk about. I just saw a patient with choroidal melanoma in clinic just a couple weeks ago who unfortunately has progressed through multiple lines of immunotherapy now and looking for a trial. So, you know, we do have those anecdotal evidence of seeing these patients, but it is quite rare, only about 5 million, or excuse me, 5 cases per million people per year. And really, up until the last 2 years, there haven't been any advancements in the field of uveal melanoma. Typically, we use chemotherapy and response rates and survival kind of mirrored cutaneous melanoma, and that you know, weren't very promising in the past. And immunotherapy has been somewhat effective for uveal melanoma, but not nearly on the same scale and scope of what we've seen with cutaneous melanoma. But 2 years ago, we did have our first FDA-approved drug for uveal melanoma, tebentafusp, or FUSP, depending on how you choose to pronounce it. So this is interesting for a few different reasons. It's a GP100 peptide HLA-directed CD3 T-cell engager, and it targets a specific population of patients with HLA A21 genotype, which occurs in about 30-ish percent of patients from European descent and about 10% of African descent populations. And really, you know, the trial that they did that led to the FDA approval looked at tebentafusp versus investigator's choice of ipi, nivo, or dacarbazine, and progression-free survival was shown to be about 5 or 6 months improved, which is, you know, seems modest, but it's, you know, in a field where there's been nothing prior to this, it was actually a very, very big advancement. And I think the thing that I find most interesting about this specifically, and Raul, you may have been seeing this with similar things in myeloma, like teclistamab, these T-cell engaging drugs are very interesting. And I think we're starting to see new ways to engage the immune system that we haven't seen in the past, which is really fascinating. And another interesting advancement recently, SD101, being developed by Trisalis, which the CMO, Stephen Katz, is actually here at Brown University in the Lagaretta Cancer Center. They recently published their, or presented at SITC, their preliminary data showing really, really great progression-free survival of 86% at 1 year. And they use a novel delivery mechanism of pressure-enabled delivery directly into hepatic lesions. And a lot of great correlative studies showing decreased T regulatory cells, decreased myeloid-derived stem cells. So interesting things for sure in a population where we really need to have more treatment options. So pretty exciting about the future, but you know, we've made some progress recently as well.
Yeah, Matt, I'm glad you mentioned tebentafusp. You know, even as the self-proclaimed drug nerd of the group, it just, the mechanism of just how it works, again, to me is fascinating. I describe it to my residents as just a bridge between the T cells and then the cancer cells, and physically linking them and stimulating the immune system that way. And again, I know, I'm sure Rahul has treated patients, you know, talquetamab, teclistamab, other bispecifics in myeloma. The one piece I'd bring up for our audience is that whether it's myeloma, uveal melanoma, we are still watching out for some of those risks of cytokine release syndrome and other toxicities. It's been an interesting development for me that, you know, you see bispecific T-cell engaging antibodies employed across multiple disease states, but the toxicity profiles of them have been fairly consistent so far, at least in my review and experience.
Yeah, I'm really glad you raised that that point, because and Rolo, I'm not sure if you're seeing this a lot, but you know, as we've started to get more teclistamab on the inpatient service, we've had admissions for ramp up dosing, and the logistics that go into this really makes it a very big question of, you know, when we start to use more and more of these therapies, you know, we're starting to use more investigational therapies that require inpatient monitoring. You know, how are we going to manage this in more of a rural setting, a community setting, or even just outside large academic medical centers? And I think it's a pretty fair question as we start to have more and more of these therapies.
Completely agreed, especially with these novel kind of toxicity. Is it one thing if the toxicity was like bleeding, like Caplacizumab, like that toxicity, you know, any oncologist, hematologist can handle that. This is a little bit of a unique situation. One thing I don't think I'd realized, and I'm sorry I was on mute earlier, was the HLA restriction. I actually had not realized that at all until you brought it up. And so maybe one, Matt, not to put you on the spot, but is there a reason that it wouldn't work in other HLA subtypes? And is that like a genomic, what the patient has HLA or what the tumor cells are presenting? And two, the follow-up to that, how, you know, with these advanced therapeutics comes advanced diagnostics, how typically is that being sent for patients with uveal melanoma? Obviously rare, but is this testing also being sent?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly send it for anyone with uveal melanoma, and I think it's encouraged that everyone should at time of diagnosis. And it is it's the a genetic HLA subtype. It has to do with the peptide expression and the binding of the drug, which is unfortunate because, you know, if you think about uveal melanoma being pretty rare, only about a third of patients actually have that HLA subtype. So I mean, we really are getting into a small subset of patients that this therapy is available for, but you know, I do think it's a good therapy that is good for the patients that it's available for, and you know, has been used quite frequently now for the last couple of years.
Agreed. Just good to see. Maybe should we pivot now? We're coming up against the half hour mark here. All right, Nagashima, maybe I'll call on you next then. So moving from uveal melanoma slightly down to here now, you know, rare disorders, rare cancers, I should say, in your realm, and progress you think has been made, progress that hasn't been made, and so forth.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about cancers that really are, you know, so rare that they're setting up global registries. So not midline carcinoma, parathyroid carcinoma, you know, tumors of that nature that are really rare. The progress is that people have started recognizing these as entities, and we've started collecting information and registries. The lack of progress is that, I mean, they're so rare that you don't really have, these are young individuals who, we know what they have. I mean, again, one of the unifying factors for many of these tumors is a genomic unifier. So if there is a, you know, let's say there is a, an actionable mutation that we can target, you know, irrespective of the type of tumor, that's one thing. But then we have tumors that have really, they have mutations and they have, you know, translocations, but they, at this time, they're not targetable. That is a situation where we really, I don't think, the only progress we've made is that we now know what they are. We don't know how to treat them. The insurance companies are at a standstill because there's nothing approved in the space. So we are left to kind of, you know, work with the individual patients. And we use a lot of strategies that we use in other types of tumors, immunotherapy being, you know, checkpoint inhibitors being an example, in which case a lot of times we end up, you know, writing extensive letters of support with very limited data that we can gather from, you know, individual case reports. But so far, I've been extremely lucky. The pharma has been extremely collaborative, and we've been able to get, you know, expensive medications to these patients to great therapeutic benefit. So that's, you know, when I'm talking about really rare diseases, coming to a little more, you know, commoner diseases. I'm talking about salivary gland tumors. Within that, we have so many subtypes. And you know, like when you look at the data, it's all clubbed together. So, you have, you know, there's not much available. But then each individual is an individual by themselves. There's, you know, and we don't have that type of granular data. Now we have started subclassifying them based on, again, you know, like enteric fusion, for example, or classifying them based on androgen receptor overexpression or HER2. We have some genomic classifiers, but that's probably the advance that we have. You know, we have some more treatments to offer to these patients. But for the most part, I would say that we are more at a standstill and dealing with, you know, patients on an individual basis.
So this is very illuminating for me. Because I remember when the HER2 connection with some of these salivary gland tumors came out, we were like, this is really cool. And in reality, it's much more complicated than that. Maybe in reverse order, I'll ask about that. If you are able to identify a targetable mutation for which something from the melanoma space, for BRAF, or something from the, I guess breast or esophageal space like HER2 applies, has it been easy for you to be able to treat these patients off label with a targeted therapy, or it's been, kicking and screaming with the insurance company every
Yeah,
time?
it's a challenge. It's a hit or miss. I mean, I have patients right now who I was able to get HER2 directed therapies for HER2 overexpressed salivary gland tumors. Come January, their insurance changed. The new insurance refuses to continue the medication that has been benefiting the patient. So I'm forced to terminate something that was working for the patient. I mean, that's a very hard discussion. I mean, multiple letters of support have been submitted. So now we are like, okay, if there is progression, let's see, it's a hard discussion. On the other hand, similarly, I've been able to. I know that I have a patient with a rare head and neck tumor with a PIK3CA mutation, progressed on multiple agents, and I was able to get alpelisib, and patient had a great response. It's been over a year now with a great response. It was off-label use of the medication. The company was the manufacturer was great to provide. January, they changed their policies in who they were going to approve this for. The patient no longer qualifies. The medication has stopped. So now it's a social situation. I mean, the qualification was based on the fact that the spouse, the combined income did not qualify for the for their for the whatever threshold they had. They were even thinking of breaking up for the purposes of continuing the medication. It's really a socially and emotionally a very difficult thing, but thankfully, like I said, we've been able to work around around the bends and able to get our patients what they need for the most part.
The other thing too
Agreed.
is, as
Go ahead, Kara.
targeted therapies have grown, we've got new targets that are identified. I found it again interesting to see that, okay, what's a driver mutation like the PIK3CA you mentioned versus carriers? How do we know? Well, we've got something targetable, but are we targeting the right thing? I think that's definitely an area where more research is needed, especially as we're seeing these mutations pop up in what are currently non-FDA approved or off-label situations.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's again, there are some, basket trials, if you will, that are looking at this. But even within that, we do know that depending on the primary site, the targetability of a mutation is different. Meaning, you may not have the You may not be able to get the same response if it's lung cancer versus if it's colon cancer. And putting all of them in the same basket sometimes gives you confusing results, and I don't know how you can utilize that in a global space.
Yeah, I'm so glad you made that point, because one thing that I've been thinking for like the last 5 or 10 minutes is that I could see tissue agnostic basket trials being beneficial for rare tumors, because if you did get an FDA approval and it's lumped in, then it's easy to get the drug approved. But it really does raise the question, and I've seen this with a couple basket trials where you may have two patients with a certain type of tumor, and then 10 or 13 of another type, and then you wonder if the endpoint that was met was actually, those two were just being brought up by the rest, or if there was actually a benefit there. And it's very hard to tease out. And basket, that's one of the problems I think that's not being talked about enough with basket trials.
This is an excellent segue, because I think we were going to talk, maybe, in the last 10, 15 minutes about, how do we improve care for patients with rare diseases and include both hematologic, like malignant and non-malignant, and this might be with clinical trials. That's a good example. I think basket trials are important in some ways, but you're right. There's all the heterogeneity you're not missing behind the scenes that can be a problem. And we'll talk about practice. We talked about, we'll come back and talk about the insurance issue separately. But I think, you know, are there advice that all of you would have or good practices you have seen with basket trial or just trials for rare diseases that make some trials more feasible or more useful than others?
I was going to say, I can't think of any particular trial designs or things right offhand. But the point I would make is that, you know, at diagnosis, when we're identifying and working up some of these patients with rare conditions, it's really just the underscoring the importance of the genetic testing and whatever tests you're running. I think we need to keep that broad swath of tests and complements out there to make sure that, you know, maybe something in the past, I think of like NTRK fusions, and maybe we weren't looking for them in the past, but now we are because we've got an agent for it. I would encourage clinicians in the audience to keep a broad mind when it comes to some of that testing.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I think I was thinking a similar thought. You know, there's been multiple papers that have come out. You know, there was one in JCO just a couple of years ago that outside large academic medical centers, the amount of whole exome sequencing or targeted mutation panels, particularly in lung cancer, which is very pertinent, is really, really below where it should be, you know, less than 50%. So, you know, constantly raising awareness that there are targeted therapies out there. And, you know, to Nagashree's point, you know, it has someone with a PIK3CA mutation and does really, really well with copanlisib, like you may be opening up an option, or it may be something where it doesn't work as well as it did in the trial, but at least you're opening up options that otherwise wouldn't have happened. So it's a really great point to make.
And when you have done that, for example, Nagashi, you didn't have to do a single patient IND. You just did it off pay because it's approved. You just got like a insurance to cover, or you had the separate program that covered it, right?
Well, in this case, it was an off-label, but I have had to go through the EAP or IND process, single patient IND process, which is obviously much more cumbersome and you know, time-consuming, which many often our patients don't have. So I think that you know, that if there's any progress that can be made in quick order, I think it should be changed in policies and be able to get these medications. There should be committees that approve this rather than treat this as, you know, like when you do a single patient IND, it's almost like submitting a, it's like opening a clinical trial. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that it's necessary. And most of the time it's really mostly cut and paste that I'm doing from, you know, from approved indications or whatever it is. It should be a much quicker process. And there can be a panel of reviewers because you don't want to misuse the process, but at the same time, it can be made much more easier, I think.
Agreed. What you're saying is, you know, like the IND is a lot of work for one patient. A basket trial is a lot of work to get off the ground, and ideally to be something in between that can, you know, allow patients to get these drugs, but in a way that somehow someone can kind of keep tabs and say, oh, look, you know, in the real world setting, this is happening, and so forth. Maybe, you know, pivoting slightly to that point, like you had mentioned, you know, it's rare tumors you need global registries for. I mean, I think for us, you know, for POEM syndrome as an example of you know, plasma cell disorders, we're working on creating like a national POEMs registry to get a better sense of what's happening in the real world. We have a good transplant registry, so CABMTR. So for patients with POEMs who get transplanted, we know exactly what's happening. For everybody else, we know nothing of what's happening. Any experience that any of you have had with making these kind of real-world collaboratives or real-world data collection initiatives for these rare conditions, either in the U.S. or globally, and, you know, what works about them, how do you get them started, and so forth?
I think here in the U.S., I've collaborated with some of the physicians in my group and residents. Like, we've written case reports, which is one way to get things out there. But then you can get further into the weeds of, well, is it the journal you submit to, is it carried on PubMed or others? Like, how available is that report going to be? You know, I'm almost thinking now if there was a way, like you talk about national registries or global registries, and this could just be my own ignorance. Maybe there is something out there, but just almost a forum, a registry where if we do have these rare cases and rare diseases and we're treating patients off label with agents, I think almost like having a repository where clinicians could go and search to see, okay, maybe I've got a rare head and neck salivary gland tumor. but it tested PIK3CA positive. Has anybody else done this in a place where clinicians could go to find that type of information?
That's a brilliant idea. Go ahead, Brad.
No, yeah, I was just going to say that's a great, that's, I think you just found like a side hustle. What I was thinking is, you know, one of the silver linings of the COVID-19 pandemic was the COVID consortium. I think that's something, you know, Jeremy Warner's here at Brown, and he really helped spearhead that. And I think when you get enough interest in people and people feel passionately enough, these things can come together pretty fast. It's certainly possible. I think it just, you know, you got to find the right people that are willing to engage and do the work, because honestly, no registry ever happens unless people at all these centers put the work in and actually get data. And it's hard to find those teams of people, but, you know, we have seen examples where it's worked.
Agreed. The publication angle is interesting because you need that incentive for people. I mean, even for our real world, like myeloma CAR-T consortium, is a lot of work for data coordinators to put all these data points in, or, you know, ends up being put on the fellow the day before for us to ask, or the ASCO deadline being go, 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 put all these charts in. And I think there needs to be a better way of doing that, because I agree with you. I think for a lot of the rare diseases, this is where what one center is doing and is working for those patients, nobody else finds out about, unless you happen to bring it up on social media or at a talk. And like, that's not a very efficient way of doing this.
Right. And to your point, I mean, it's, I think none of us all think, you know, we all want to do things that are good and make patient care better, but there has to be some type of tangible outcomes, like publications or presentations or something you're a part of, because otherwise it just falls down the priority list too far and it just doesn't get done. And you know, it's just kind of part, I mean, we're all so busy and we all have patient responsibilities that has to be a part of it. And I think any of those endeavors, the engine really has to be an academic one. People have to really want to, you know, pull their results and publish them and get that out there.
Agreed. And sometimes, you know, and those case reports or case series or small cohorts, you know, are important, not just to say how things are done, but then when a new condition comes along, the FDA has, you know, look favorably upon using a, you know, real world control arm, meaning that the control arm is historical, but is how they would have done otherwise. And here's what's happening with this new drug. Obviously not great. Like, obviously I'd prefer for every drug ever to have a randomized controlled trial, phase 3. That's not going to happen with a rare disease, even a phase 3 trial, unlikely to happen with a rare disease. So I think getting those real world data are supremely important. Maybe go ahead, Matt. Were you about to say something?
No. I'm good.
Okay, perfect. Maybe the last question I'll ask just to close it out would be maybe to hear from each of you, and Nagatri might have had to drop off as she comes back, and we will, is for patients with rare diseases, you know, any advice for them? Because I think, you know, let's say in each of your respective realms that we talked about, you know, what would you tell them about how to navigate rare diseases, not as a clinician, like as a patient? And maybe, you know, I'll go last. How about that? Because otherwise I can keep talking forever. So I can go around. Any brave volunteers, what advice you would tell for patients on Rare Disease Day?
Yeah. You know, I think it helps to hear the patient's voice. A lot of times, I mean, we have seen, we have seen groups, right, patient advocacy groups for, let's say, KRAS, you know, and we have KRAS kickers, you know, we have a group of, you know, EGFR resistors, etc. I know that there is a group for rare diseases. I do know that. But at the same time, I don't know it's because it's so rare and so diverse, I think it makes it difficult. So I think a patient's voice is important. Social media can be definitely used as a platform to express, you know, or reach out to individuals who might have experience in treating a particular condition that's so rare. I encourage my patients to use the social, media platform to reach out to experts or people who might have had some experience with their specific type of disease. When we spoke about earlier about case reports, I think it's extremely important to understand the value of case reports. In general, they're not, but in rare diseases, it is of extreme importance, because one case may be worth so many others, I know, when you compare to other more common conditions. So cooperate. I mean, not, I would say, you know, collaborating with the clinician to write a case report, putting in a personal piece, you know, that many journals now allow might be helpful as well. It might help them. It might help others in similar situation across the globe.
That was excellently stated. Absolutely. I have very little to add. I agree with you, Nagashi, on all fronts. Thoughts from the other panelists?
No, I completely agree. That was very, very well said. And I think in my experience, the one thing I would say is that I don't think any patient ever wants to hear that they have, it's a horrible thing to have cancer or a condition like TTP or PNH. And no one ever wants to hear, this is really rare. So, you know, almost in saying like you won the wrong kind of a lottery. I think we just always have to be mindful with the kind of language you use with patients, because, you know, those types of comments can really make people feel not so good about their condition that they're already not feeling so good about. So I've seen that happen before, and I think it's important to highlight that.
I'll take a slightly different track before we have any questions from the audience, but kind of working directly with patients as you do, you know, I do a lot of patient education and counseling on therapies. And I've heard patients joke about it, like, oh yeah, I always wanted to be the 1%. This just isn't the 1% that I thought I'd be part of. But I would put in a bit of a plug for some of my patients continuing to function as their own advocates, like the social media aspect and trying to find out some of those support groups. You know, I think too, on us like a clinical side, keeping an open mind to some of those questions or concerns or ideas that patients bring in, like maybe there's some validity to it and it's something we haven't considered, maybe it's not. But I would just encourage patients who have rare diseases, keep on your own research, own sites, continue to advocate for yourself, because again, at least in my own experience, many of these conditions, you know, certainly we might know a little bit more than a patient who's had it. But I think about an interaction I had, full disclosure, I'm a type 1 diabetic. I've been since I was 10, and you know, saw a new endocrinologist a couple of years ago. And our first visit, he's just like, okay, you've had this disease for 30 plus years. I've only been treating it for 10. Let's work together to find what's best for you. And I think that kind of approach is really what's needed in rare diseases.
Thank you, Joe, for sharing that. Completely agreed. Yeah, I mean, and the last thing I'll say is obviously, you know, while rare diseases individually are rare, I think there's some estimates that like 250, 300 million people worldwide are living with what's considered a rare disease, right? So the numbers clearly add up, and we need strategies like this that involve patient advocacy, patients reaching for themselves, patients working with physicians to make this happen, and pharmacists and the whole team. So at this point, you know, I think we'll wrap up here from in terms of scheduled remarks. Any chance that anyone on the live stream has had any questions so far?
We actually don't have any questions yet, but I'll say this recording will stay up on YouTube after it's over. So if anybody has any questions, feel free to type them into the chat and we can always answer them offline after the fact.
Perfect. Absolutely. We were all happy to help. I mean, and obviously we are not the experts in every single rare disease. If we can't answer, we'll find people who do. Because I think that's the other part of this, is that the network of physicians needs to be intact to find out, well, if you don't know what to do, or haven't seen this many of these patients, you know, you don't get penalized for phoning a friend, right? Like, this is exactly what we need, because we need that expertise, and this is how the expertise forms. But just having seen 5 more patients than your colleague has for something like POEM syndrome, uveal melanoma, that's a lot. So I think to wrap up here, again, we encourage people, if you have questions, feel free to reach out to us or through this or through the i3 Health portal. You know, thank you all for taking the time to join us for Rare Disease Day. Today is February 29th, 2024, a leap year. Again, rare diseases are rarer than a leap year is, but super important. And I think I learned a lot, certainly, from my co-panelists. So thank you all for your time.
Yes, thank all of you so much. It was wonderful to hear your perspectives on this. And thank you to the audience for tuning in. Hope everybody has a great rest of the day.
Great. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.